This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Super Bowl Sunday. Besides the football and the halftime show, there's the food, the pizza, the chips and dip, and for many, the beer. We all know it's not the healthiest way to eat, and we could probably just as easily put veggies and hummus on the table. So why do we keep going for the fatty, salty stuff? What makes it all so good anyway? Joining me now to explain what's going on in our brains when we make these kinds of food choices is Rachel Herz. She's a neuroscientist who studies smell, and she's written a book called Why You Eat What You Eat. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Heather. It's great to be on.
If you look up a Super Bowl game day menu, I mean, there are things that come up every single time, right? And it's wings, it's pizza, it's burgers, it's chips and dip, it's nachos, like salty, fatty carbs is kind of the theme there with all of those things. What's going on there?
Well, I think there's a couple of simple explanations. One of them actually just has to do with tradition. It's kind of like, why is pumpkin pie associated with Thanksgiving? It's because it just started becoming a dessert that everybody brought. And potentially, unfortunately, things like nachos and chicken wings and loaded potato skins and things like that have become the traditional foods of Super Bowl parties. But the additional part of it is that it seems like a celebration, and it's part of what sort of gets people into the mood of the game. So eating those foods, because they also make us feel good, is part of what actually keeps us going when we're in the mode of watching the Super Bowl.
I mean, we all know it's a guilty pleasure, right? So what actually makes it feel good to eat those foods?
Well, you know, special occasions are when people feel like they can give themselves a license to ill, as it were, when it comes to eating. And so we give ourselves passes on things like Thanksgiving, on New Year's Eve, and the Super Bowl. You know, the Super Bowl is actually the second biggest eating day of the year after Thanksgiving.
Wow.
So there's kind of an acknowledged, you know, we're going to be bad today and it's okay, but we don't do this every day.
There's also the effect of the smells, the sounds, the lighting that's around you when you're making food choices. You think about a Super Bowl party, probably lots of people, loud, there's a TV going. How does all of that affect the kinds of food choices that we make?
Definitely with respect to the stimulation around us, one of the biggest factors with respect to food consumption is actually social stimulation. The more people we eat with, the more we eat. And there again, there's some sort of straightforward explanations. One, with more people over, you're going to have made more food and they're going to have brought food. So there's a lot more food around when you have 25 people over than if you only have three. Plus, the food is sort of sitting around. It's in front of the TV. It's on the table nearby. And the longer you're in front of food, the more likely you are to eat food. In addition, you have this amazing distraction of the Super Bowl game itself, as well as the commercials and the conversation. So you're not paying very much attention to what you're eating. And this is another big slip when it comes to food consumption. When we're distracted, we tend to eat a lot more. And television is a major culprit for that.
You already mentioned the idea that, you know, we kind of give ourselves a pass because this is one day, one event. It's not how we're going to eat every day. But what about the day after? I mean, do we all go on kind of a repentant diet?
So the Monday after a Super Bowl, the way we eat actually has a lot to do with whether or not our home team has won or lost, and also how dedicated we are as fans. So, for example, for New England fans, on Monday, if by, you know, rare possible chance the Patriots lose, it's more likely that people will binge actually on high fat foods on that Monday. So people feeling that loss of their home team are going to be eating more pizza, eating more nachos, kind of drowning their sorrows in comfort foods. Whereas if your home team wins, then on that following Monday, you're actually less likely to eat comfort food that day and, in fact, may follow a somewhat healthier diet. So you'll be eating, you know, a green salad, hold the dressing, but it doesn't have to do necessarily with repentance from the day before. Because if your home team loses, then your big munch out on Monday is not compensated for on Tuesday. So if you're drowning your sorrows in pizza and chips on Monday, on Tuesday, you're not going to have salads instead. You're just going to eat regularly.
Rachel Herz, you're a neuroscientist who studies smell. And I have to wonder, with all of these different factors that we're talking about, I mean, we tend to think we make food choices because something smells good, it tastes good, right? That's why we want to eat it. How much actually do those senses have to do with determining what we decide to pick up and put in our mouths?
Well, certainly the sense of smell is a tremendous lure when it comes to food, as well as it is what actually gives food flavor. So taste is really just salty, sour, sweet, and bitter. And everything else that you experience from eating is due to your nose, is due to the aromas from your mouth getting up from your mouth into your nose and synergizing with the taste of the food itself and creating the flavor. So that is to say, the taste of bacon is just salt. It's the aromas coming from that strip of bacon as you're chewing it that get up into your nostrils that then bind with the taste of salt and make it that amazing sensation. So first of all, that's the experience of eating. And then secondly, of course, we can be completely led by our nostrils when something smells really good. And this can override feelings of hunger. So, you know, it's kind of dangerous to be around food that's cooking when you're, you know, you're maybe a little bit hungry, but you don't necessarily have to eat and something smells really good, you're going to dive in. However, if you're stuffed, then the smell of that same favorite food can actually become unpleasant because it's like, if I have to see another chicken wing or I have to smell another chicken wing, I'm going to be sick. So it all depends on your internal state.
I was fascinated to read in your book, Why You Eat What You Eat, that the whole idea of a map of taste buds around our tongue, that we taste different things with different parts of our tongue, that's actually a false idea. But the story of how it came about is kind of fascinating. Where did that idea even come from?
Yeah, so this is kind of an interesting little social science history where what happened was in the early 1940s, Edwin Boring, who is a professor at Harvard University, read a paper that was written by a German graduate student in German, and he misinterpreted the results as saying that the tip of the tongue is where you taste sweet, the sides of the tongue are for salty and sour, and the back of the tongue is for bitter. And he published his interpretation, his in English, in a very popular, very famous textbook in the early mid-1940s, and it soon became repeated and repeated and very easily could be visually illustrated like a map. And so the tongue map was born and just got repeated and so on and so forth. And then in the early mid-1970s, Virginia Collings, who is a graduate student at the University of Pittsburgh, decided to go back to that original experiment and do her own taste testing. And she actually found what in fact was what the original student had found, which is that there are tiny differences in certain specific places, but basically we can taste every taste sensation everywhere. She published her results, but nothing really happened in terms of, you know, the popular zeitgeist. And, you know, when there's a simple explanation and it can be easily illustrated and it's been repeated, it's really hard to get that out of our collective consciousness and to get the more kind of murky, complicated, not very sexy drawing or no drawing at all, you know, to be the reality.
Well, I mean, when you said we can taste everything everywhere, you were referring to the tongue. But then you also write that we, in fact, have taste receptors in all sorts of places all over and all inside our bodies. I mean, where else are these taste receptors and why?
So we have taste receptors in our stomach, in our pancreas, in our lungs, in our intestines. If you're a man, you have taste receptors in your testicles.
Okay, and that's just, I mean, the ones in your digestive tract, you might be able to.
Yeah. So, well, the way you need to think about this, so only the taste receptors that are in our tongue are hooked up to our brain in terms of the taste cortex. So we can only taste, you know, something sweet with our tongue. We can't taste something as being sweet with our lungs or elsewhere. Now, the reason why we have these taste receptors in different parts of our bodies is because taste receptors are really chemical detection systems. And we detect chemicals throughout our body. And actually, from the point of view of testicles, if you're a man, so sperm have to find an egg. And the way that they swim towards the egg is actually by sensing chemical signals coming from the egg to direct it towards it. Now, interestingly, though, the taste receptors that are in our lungs are, in fact, responding sort of more directly, possibly, to things we're ingesting. So if you breathe in something noxious, you cough. So the receptors that are responding to those chemicals in your lungs are trying to expel them out of your body. And actually, the taste receptors in our intestines, where we're doing food digestion, are responding to chemicals that are in foods and also letting us know, is this something that made us feel good to eat? Or was this something that, made us feel kind of sick to eat? So there's an interaction between food and the taste receptors in our stomach, but it's more indirect and a little more complicated than the obvious ones that happen in our mouth.
I'm talking with Rachel Herz. She's a neuroscientist and author of Why You Eat What You Eat. I mean, you're talking about, the taste receptors in your intestine, whether you feel good or bad, the physical, physiological level, whether something is making you nauseous or not. But we were talking before about foods making us feel good on an emotional level. And we have this phrase, emotional eaters. Aren't we all emotional eaters?
Yes, to a certain extent, I think we're all emotional eaters, although there are a small set of people who claim that their only reason and need for food is for fuel. This was probably why Soylent was ever invented in the first place, though not very successfully, because there's no pleasure from it. So we, generally speaking, love to consume foods that are high in sugar, high in fat, high in carbohydrates, so they could also be salty. And these are foods that make us feel good neurobiologically. So our brain actually responds like something really fantastic is happening when we taste sweet, when we taste fat. And it actually both turns on the pleasure and reward centers of our brain and reduces pain, both physically and emotionally. So if you're kind of in an emotional pain state, eating things that are high sugar and high fat actually, momentarily at least, make us feel better. Now, the problem is the momentarily component of it, because oftentimes afterwards, we then feel even worse emotionally because oh my God, I just ate a whole tub of ice cream. Now I feel even more awful, even though at the time it did feel good to consume it. So one of the things I like to sort of counsel people, very loosely stated, is to ask yourself the question while you're consuming something, whether or not you're in a state of emotional distress or just loving what you're eating, is the experience of pleasure worth the calories or whatever is going to be the end result of eating this? So the first scoop of or bite or spoonful of ice cream or cake or cookies or chocolate or french fries, yes, that tastes delicious. I want more. But what about after the fifth bite or the 10th bite? And so if you are at least present enough in your mind to be able to assess, this is no longer giving me what I started eating this for, then that's the time to stop. The problem is most people don't start thinking that question until they're way beyond, the time that they really should have stopped from the point of view of pleasure.
There are tricks that can trick us into eating more. Maybe I shouldn't call them tricks, right? But we've talked about some of these emotional or environmental factors, like more people being around, right? Or just being distracted. Are there ways we can use some of that to maybe trick ourselves into eating more healthfully?
Yes. I mean, the biggest tip really is to just pay attention, because the more engaged you are with eating, the more satisfaction you get from it and the more satiation you get from it. So you'll need less to feel full. But if you want some, additional tricks and tips, one of the things that I think is really interesting, size of plate and portion size is a major issue these days. I mean, the size of plates that we have in our cupboard for regular eating were the size of serving plates 50 or 60 years ago, where the whole platter of food was being served. And so we have this idea that the amount of food on the plate is the amount that we're supposed to eat. And we also don't like it when we put only what looks like a small amount of food on a big plate, because it looks like we're getting ripped off and, oh my God, I hardly ate anything. So the idea is to use smaller plates, but maybe not like super small plates, so oh my God, I'm just giving myself a tiny plate, and to fill that plate. And one really great way of doing that potentially is to use concave bowls, so that the top of the circle of the bowl looks like it's reasonably wide, but then it narrows down quite considerably so that you don't actually get to fill it with that much food, but it looks like we have enough food and therefore we'll be satisfied with it. Another really interesting trick is to use red plates. Now, this is also a good tip for the Super Bowl party. So if you're hosting and you want to help your guests not overconsume, use small red plates for all the snacking that's going to be done. Because again, with the small size, people are going to be thinking that they're, potentially eating more when they've heaped it up. And then red actually draws our attention to what we're consuming in a way that makes us pay sort of extra vigilance to it, and has been shown to make us eat less than if food is served on, let's say, a white plate or a blue plate.
Small red plates. That's fascinating. Neuroscientist Rachel Herz, she's author of Why You Eat What You Eat. Clearly, it's not just about tasting good. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Heather. It was great to be on.